Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner. Performed by Victor Bavine. Produced by Audible Incorporated.
And where is the place of understanding? It is hid from the eyes of all living, and concealed from the birds of the air. Job, chapter 28, verses 20 through 21. Part 1. Evolution in the flesh. As we have heard, so have we seen. Psalm 48, line 8. Chapter 1. Daphne Major. The creation is never over. It had a beginning, but it has no ending. Creation is always busy making new scenes, new things, and new worlds. Immanuel Kant, A General Natural History of the Heavens. 7:30 on Daphne Major. Peter and Rosemary Grant sit themselves down on stones, a few steps from their traps. Peter opens a yellow notebook with waterproof pages. "Okay," he says. "Today is the 25th. It is the 25th of January, 1991. There are 400 finches on the island at this moment, and the Grants know every one of the birds on sight, the way shepherds can tell every sheep in their flocks. In other years, there have been more than 1,000 finches on Daphne Major, and Peter and Rosemary could still recognize each one. The flock was down to 300 once. The number is falling toward that now. The birds have gotten less than 1/5 of an inch of rain in the last 44 months. In 1,320 days, 5 millimeters of rain. The Grants and the Grants' young daughters and a long line of assistants keep coming back to this desert island like sentries on a watch. They have been observing Daphne Major for almost 2 decades, or about 20 generations of finches. By now, Peter and Rosemary Grant know many of the birds' family trees by heart, again like shepherds or like Bible scholars, who know that Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Abraham also begat Joshen, who begat Dedan, who begat Ashurim, Letushim, and Leumim. In each generation, there are always a few birds, just 1 or 2 in 100, that keep away from the Grants and refuse to be caught. This morning, Rosemary, after a week of watching and plotting, has just captured 2 of the wariest, most difficult finches on the island. She caught them both in the space of a single minute, high on the island's north rim, next to a fallen cactus pad, in black box traps baited with green bananas. "How about that?" she cried, when the trap's doors clicked shut. And when Peter strode through the cactus trees and across the lava rubble to join her, Rosemary lifted up her first prize, fluttering in a blue pouch. "I deserve a bottle of wine for this." Now the Grants are sitting beside the traps at the edge of a cliff, 100 meters above the Pacific Ocean. Except for the honking and whistling of 2 masked boobies, courting on a rock nearby, the scene is quiet. The ocean is more than Pacific. It is flat as a pond. The morning's weather is what Charles Darwin described in his diary when he first saw the Galapagos Archipelago. A steady, gentle breeze of wind and gloomy sky. From the upper rim of Daphne Major, on clearer mornings than this one, Rosemary and Peter can see the island of Santiago, where Darwin camped for 9 days. They can also see the island of Isabella, where Darwin spent 1 day. They can make out more than 12 other islands and block lava ruins that Darwin never had a chance to visit, including an islet known officially as Sin Nombre, that is, nameless, and another black speck called Eden. "If I have seen further," Isaac Newton once wrote with celebrated modesty, "it is by standing upon the shoulders of giants." The dark volcanoes of the Galapagos are Darwin's shoulders. These islands meant more to him than any other stop in his 5-year voyage around the world. Origin of all my views, he called them once. The origin of the origin of the species. The Grants are doing what Darwin could not do, going back to the Galapagos year after year. And the Grants are seeing there what Darwin did not imagine could be seen at all. Rosemary unlatches their toolkit, a tackle box. From it, Peter extracts a pair of jeweler's spectacles, a plastic mask with bulging lenses, which make him look like Robinson Crusoe from Mars. "Okay, famous bird," Peter says. "Ow, famous bird has decided to bite the hand that feeds him." He grasps the finch with one hand, and its head sticks out observantly from his fist. The bird is about the size of a sparrow and jet black, with a black beak and shiny dark eyes. Rosemary hands Peter a pair of calipers. "Now, here we go," Peter says. "Wing length, 72 millimeters. Rosemary jots the number in the yellow notebook. "Tarsus length, 21.5. The tarsus is the bird's leg. Rosemary writes it down. "Beak length, 14.9 millimeters. Peter recites. "Beak depth, 8.8. "Beak width, 8 millimeters. "Black 5 plumage." The Grants rate the bird's plumage from 0, which is brown, to 5, totally black. Black 5 means a mature male. Beak black. Normally, these birds' beaks are pale, the color of horn. A black beak means the bird is ready to mate. Peter dangles the bird in a little weighing cup. Weight, 22.2 grams. "This bird has lived a long time," he muses. 13 years. There are only 3 others of its generation still alive on the island, and none older. But I don't think there's a single one of his offspring flying around. Not one has made it to the breeding season. The bird has been a father many times, and never once a grandfather. Peter puts a gray ring and a brown ring on the bird's left ankle. He puts a light green ring over a metal one on its right ankle. Bands like these, and an ingenious color code, help the Grant team to keep track of their flocks from dawn to dusk, from the cliffs at the base of the island to this guano-painted rubble at the rim. Peter holds the bird in his fist one more time and inspects its beak in profile. In rushing up to join Rosemary at the rim, he has forgotten his camera. Otherwise, he would photograph the bird just so, from a distance of 27 centimeters. That is the Grant's standard mugshot for one of Darwin's finches. The Origin of Species says very little about the origin of species. Darwin's full title is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Yet the book does not document the origin of a single species, or a single case of natural selection, or the preservation of one favored race in the struggle for life. Darwin talks about the breeding of pigeons. He talks about Malthus, fossils, patterns in the geographic distribution of the world's flora and fauna. He marshals an enormous mass of evidence that evolution has happened. Yet Darwin never saw it happen, either in the Galapagos, where he spent only 5 weeks, or anywhere else. "It may metaphorically be said," he writes in a famous passage, "that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing, throughout the world, the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good, silently and insensibly working, whenever and wherever opportunity offers. We see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the lapse of ages, and then so imperfect is our view into long past geological ages that we see only that the forms of life are now different from what they formerly were." That is Darwinism for Darwin. life changes down through the generations. The chief mechanism of change is the process that Darwin called natural selection. This process is at work right now around us, whenever and wherever opportunity offers, as Darwin emphasizes with italics, not confined to a moment of creation in the dim past. It goes on this year as much as last year, now and forever, here and everywhere, like Newton's laws of motion. But the action and reaction are too slow to watch. The invisibility of the process made its demonstration more difficult for Darwin, although the naturalist Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's self-appointed bulldog and griffin, "I am sharpening up my beak and claws in readiness," he wrote, as The Origin went on sale, met critics head-on. It has been urged, for instance, that in his chapters on the struggle for existence and on natural selection, Mr. Darwin does not so much prove that natural selection does occur as that it must occur, Huxley wrote. But in fact, no other sort of demonstration is attainable. A race does not attract our attention in nature until it has, in all probability, existed for a considerable time, and then it is too late to inquire into the conditions of its origin. Huxley gave a public lecture with the title, "The Demonstrative Evidence of Evolution." His evidence was a series of extinct ancestors of the modern horse, beginning with Eohippus, the dawn horse, now called Hyracotherium, which lived and died about 50 million years ago. The naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace published "A Demonstration of the Origin of Species by Natural Selection," which consisted of a brief table divided in two columns. The left-hand column listed the keys to the process of natural selection. Like Newton's laws of motion, they are so few and so simple that they can be written on the back of an envelope. The right-hand column listed the logical consequences of these laws, ending with "changes of organic forms," or evolution. Wallace headed the items on the left, proved facts, and the items on the right, necessary consequences, afterwards taken as proved facts. Fossils argued that evolution has happened. Logic argued that natural selection can make it happen. But neither bones nor logic could demonstrate the one leading to the other, natural selection causing evolution. In 1893, in an essay entitled "The All-Sufficiency of Natural Selection," the German biologist August Weismann confessed that "it is really very difficult to imagine this process of natural selection in its details, and to this day it is impossible to demonstrate it in any one point." A few biologists did try to demonstrate it at the turn of the century. A Yankee biologist named Herman Carey Bumpus thought he saw it at work among a flock of sparrows in Providence, Rhode Island. Other investigators reported natural selection in action among crabs in Plymouth Sound, moths in Yorkshire birch trees, mice in sandhills on an island in Dublin Bay, and chicks in a Long Island poultry yard. But most of these sightings were brief and ambiguous. Bumpus's database was a single snowstorm. The work tended to be neglected by both sides of the debate. Mountains of books and papers, technical and popular, were published about evolutionary theory. Much of this literature approached the level of abstraction of the medieval scholiast's angels on the head of a pin. Some of the most learned interpretations of Darwinism were more or less unconstrained by reality. In crucial ways, for all the mountainous literature, the theory of evolution by natural selection was still a proof on the back of an envelope, and the origin of species remained what Darwin called, in his Journal of the Beagle Voyage, that mystery of mysteries. If ever an idea cried and begged for an experimental research program, a geneticist lamented in 1934, surely it is this one. But there have been so very, very few of them. A quarter century later, in 1960, another geneticist wrote that the amount of observation or experiment so far carried out upon evolution in wild populations was still surprisingly small. He found this impoverished state of affairs disturbing because evolution is the fundamental problem of biology, while observation and experiment are the fundamental tools of science. In 1990, in a one-volume Encyclopedia of Evolution, a physical anthropologist wrote that the complaint of a half century ago holds good. The number of experimental tests of natural selection is pitiful. The few that have been conducted still do heavy duty as exemplars. This is also the burden of the creationist's cry, only a theory. According to a little paperback entitled The Handy Dandy Evolution Refuter, whose cover bears the gold seal of the Chapel of the Air in Wheaton, Illinois, neither evolution nor creation can be tested as a scientific theory, so believers in evolution or creation must accept either view by faith. Duane Gish, the most prominent creationist writer today, declares in his book, Evolution? The Fossils Say No. By creation we mean the bringing into being by a supernatural creator of the basic kinds of plants and animals by the process of sudden or fiat creation. We do not know how the creator created, what processes he used, for he used processes which are not now operating anywhere in the natural universe. Today, more and more evolutionists are doing what Darwin thought impossible. They are studying the evolutionary process not through fossils, but directly, in real time, in the wild. Evolution in the flesh. Evolution comes from the Latin evolutio, an unrolling, unfolding, opening. Biologists are observing year by year, and sometimes even day by day or hour by hour, details of life's unrolling and opening, right now. So many new studies are coming out that one investigator has published a technical guide for evolution watchers. A detailed and rigorous book entitled Natural Selection in the Wild. The centerpiece of the book is a table, direct demonstrations of natural selection. This table begins to supply what Darwin, Huxley, Wallace, and Weismann never could. It lists more than 140 instances in which a piece of the Darwinian process has been documented. Some of these case studies, like Bumpus's sparrows, are only flashes in the storm, glimpses of the process that is at work around us. But many of the latest studies, like the Grants, are remarkably, almost panoramically complete. Taken together, these new studies suggest that Darwin did not know the strength of his own theory. He vastly underestimated the power of natural selection. Its action is neither rare nor slow. It leads to evolution daily and hourly all around us, and we can watch. The Grants are leaders of this field, and they are among its ideal representatives. Year after year, they go back to the most celebrated place in the study of evolution, the place that helped lead the young Darwin to his theory, the Galapagos, the Enchanted Islands. There they observe Darwin's finches, the birds that Darwin was the first naturalist to collect, the birds whose beaks inspired his first veiled hints about his revolutionary theory. The birds whose portraits in textbooks and encyclopedias have now introduced so many generations to Darwinism that they have become international symbols of the process, totems of evolution, like the overshot brows and cumulus beard of Darwin himself.